The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
How old were you when you started writing?
66.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman. In the studio with me is newspaper columnist and rancher Richard Gary. During the next half hour, he'll read some of his essays and talk about what it's been like to be a rancher in Montana during the past six decades. You grew up in the area of a town called Helmville in western Montana. What was it like when you grew up there, and what's it like now?
There's been a change. As a child, born in 47, and there was still the post-World War II exuberance. The men were still heroes. They came home from saving the world, and ranches had some money then. They were relatively affluent. And so there was an exuberance and an enthusiasm, it seems, that isn't really there anymore, given the economics of cow-calf ranching. The families were larger. We had 30 or 40 kids in the grade school, and now there are eight or nine. It's changed. It's a more solemn, somber valley than it used to be, maybe for lack of a diverse population.
Do you think it's also because of the economics?
Yes, I do. It used to be in a cow-calf operation, calves are born in March or April. They're sold in October. In the 50s, when calves were 50 cents a pound and gasoline was 35 cents a gallon, there was money to be had and money to be spent. But now the calves go on the truck, the producer gets the check, and it's straight to the bank to pay off the operating loan and start again. So the ranchers don't have the money to have a good time with anymore. They're sitting on properties worth $10 or $15 or $20 million, and they're living off $25,000 a year, if that.
For entire families.
For an entire family, yeah. And they all have small families now.
So why do ranchers stay with a business from which they can barely eke out a living? Why do they persist, as you say?
I don't really know. They say, well, you know, what else would I do? And I've asked people of my age who are, we're reaching the age of being unuseful to the younger. But it's just the tradition. They just can't imagine themselves doing anything else. And I noticed living in towns, and where I was here in Missoula, people would walk the road there, just exercise, and you could almost tell the people who have retired from a country living and moved to town. They just have an aura of boredom and desperation about them. You know, on a ranch, you walk out the door, and everything you can see is yours, and everything you can see needs some sort of work done to it, and you just keep going on. It's deeply ingrained in them, and they can't see anything else. But that's changing. I've noticed now with the younger generations there in Helmville, some of the younger 18, 20-year-old kids, the men especially, of course, it's the way it is, they're expressing a little doubt. They really can't see working 80 or 90 hours a week for $25,000 a year. And they're thinking there might be an easier way to make a living, and there certainly are easier ways, but I think the family cow-calf ranch is fading out, due in large part to the smaller families. My grandfather and grandmother raised seven boys, and I'm of a family of six, and then three half-brothers and sisters. But those families are an anachronism now. They're non-existent.
In a recently published essay, you wrote, "I'm a free thinker and an incorrigible iconoclast." And then in the next sentence, you link that statement with your alcoholism, depression, and poverty. Why are those two connected?
For some reason, I never really thought with the group at all times, of course. Hillville's a small parochial thinking community, and I was always a little bit on the fringes. Maybe just my role as somewhat of an intellectual pariah might have contributed to it. And they say, as per the alcoholism, I heard a saying once that genetics loads the gun and the environment pulls the trigger. I think that's part of my alcoholism. The link is there somehow, but it's just that I, you know, never cared a whit for public opinion or what people thought of me, as long as I was considered reasonably honest.
In one of your essays, you write about the hired men who would come through, and they set an example for you, and they would give you smaller amounts of alcohol and tobacco, mm-hmm. but you still got some.
Certainly, yeah. There might be something to that, because being the oldest, there were four of us children born in about 4.5 years, and I was the oldest. So I was never missed, really. There were three others for my mother to tend to. So I was out with the crews. And the hay crews in those days were mostly alcoholics with some sort of an emotional problem due either to alcoholism or it caused their alcoholism. And they probably impressed me because they were my heroes then. They were what I had as heroes, were these rough-hewn men that were loners. And I was with them all summer from the time I was 6 and, you know, until I didn't go in the hayfields anymore.
You got some kind of a feeling of camaraderie with them, too.
I did.
Sitting in the bunkhouse at night, hearing their stories.
Yes, and I was, you know, an 8-year-old child being accepted by the people who were your heroes is a rich experience.
So you wanted to do what they did, which was drink and smoke and...
And work.
And work.
That's all, yeah, that's all there was in their lives. And so I, you know, gravitated towards that lifestyle, I guess.
Well, as the oldest child and also as just the child of ranchers, you were given a lot of responsibility at an early age. And I remember the essay that you wrote about driving with your grandfather. Do you mind reading that one?
No, I can do that. I was down in that pasture just last week, and I never think, go by there, I don't remember this. I was 12 years old that summer, and my grandfather was in his mid-70s. He had broken his wrist at the beginning of haying and could only drive around the meadows and the roads near the ranch. Our summer pastures are about 10 miles from the home place, so that's where I came in. He monitored the progress of the haying constantly, and at least once a week, when he saw that I was far enough ahead of the stacker crew with my raking, he'd bump across the meadow in his old International pickup and stop me. It was a horrible feeling, just horrible. I knew he wanted me to chauffeur him to the pasture so he could check on his cows and his grass. The trip involved driving 10 or 12 miles of highway, then 4 or 5 miles through the pasture, and finally onto the county road and back to Helmville, making a loop of about 20 miles total. I'm only a few inches over 5 feet now and wasn't more than 4 feet tall when I was 12. That was the problem. In order to drive the old pickup, I had to hold myself up by the steering wheel so I could see the road. And when I depressed the clutch, I lost sight of everything. If I stretched my leg to its tiny fullest, I could push the accelerator only to 35 or 40 miles per hour. That didn't matter to my grandfather. He was a pragmatic individual, and as long as he was going to check his cattle, speed wasn't an issue. So off we'd go, an old man and a child. The highway was the worst because that's where the patrolmen lived. I had never seen one in my life, but I knew they were to be feared. Laws and lawmen didn't concern my grandfather, because to him, if you didn't own cattle, you were a minor character in the world and not to be taken seriously. It was his cattle that mattered, nothing else. I tried to maintain a decent speed on the highway and could wrestle the vehicle up to 40 miles per hour if I looked through the steering wheel instead of over it. My arms cramped from holding my torso off of the seat, and my leg trembled from the exertion of trying to reach the accelerator. We always made it without incident, but it was exhausting. The past year was easier because I could lean my head out the window and see the twin paths I had to follow. But always, a few times during our safaris, my grandfather would ask me to make a detour so he could look at a few head of cattle or a salt lick. That's where it got exciting. When we came to the muddy or steep places, my grandfather ordered, "Give her the gun, give her the gun." I knew what that meant, so I slid down in the seat and pushed the accelerator to the fore, driving completely blind while bouncing and rattling and roaring over rocks and badger holes and sagebrush, with the old man holding desperately onto his hat. When we had passed the hazard, the old man would shout over the screaming motor, "That's the stuff, that's the stuff," meaning we are out of danger. He never complained, and he never complimented. It was the cows that mattered to him, not bonding with a 12-year-old child. I was there for a purpose, not companionship. It took a couple of eternities, but we always made it through the pasture to the Ovando-Helmville Road. It was a gravel road, so no patrolmen were waiting to haul me to jail. I could finally relax. New problems arose, however, when we met an oncoming pickup, and my grandfather wanted to stop and talk cattle with the other driver. I couldn't reach both the clutch and the brake pedals at the same time, so I had to depress the clutch, take the pickup out of gear, and then engage the brakes. By the time I had accomplished that, we had coasted hundreds of feet past the other vehicle. I couldn't back the truck up because it was impossible for me to look out the back window, and if I attempted it blindly, I'd run off the road or hit the other pickup. It was an embarrassing dilemma, so we just sat and waited for the other person to come to us. In retrospect, I'm sure it was a blatant transgression of country protocol. You should at least back up half the distance, but I don't think my grandfather was ever shunned for it. And so it was. We made it safely every time, but it was agony. The worst of my youth, I think. But I have the memories.
You've been listening to Montana rancher and writer Richard Gary read one of his essays. This is The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman. If you'd like to hear this program again, it's available online at mtpr.org/twq and also on our Facebook page. And speaking of Facebook, go there and like us. Then you'll have access to book reviews as well as information about forthcoming books and regional authors. Stay with us. After a short break, we'll be back to talk about the agrarian work ethic and find out what Richard has to say to people who think ranching is romantic. Go back to the rural community where you grew up. You write about organized community dancing events, the role that they used to have in rural culture. Can you read that essay for us?
It's a shame you missed them. The old style country dances don't happen anymore. They've changed and aren't the community effort where two or three generations of a family can enjoy the same activity together. The old dances had names, the Duck Dance, which Ovando held every fall, and the Hay Diggers Ball, which happened in Helmville in July or August, are two that I can remember. They were events in themselves and not linked to other occasions such as New Year's or rodeo. The music was supplied by local musicians. We knew every song that would be played, and we all had our favorites. The dances weren't the stereotypical country gatherings with straw-hatted yokels or booted cowboys leaping around to music from a shrieking fiddle. They were organized affair with an unspoken protocol we all learned at an early age. And everyone went. Babysitters were rare in those days, so toddlers and even younger all had a place at the dance. It was common to see a couple of grade schoolers dancing alongside their grandparents or to see a mother or a father teaching a six-year-old to dance. When we got to high school, we country kids were all known for our dancing abilities. The interesting thing about the dances and the question that even those older than I can answer is why the music started at the late hour of 10 p.m. The best reason we can think of is that ranches had a lot of chores in those days, plus there were often four or five children to get washed and dressed. Even in the short days of winter, the music started at 10 o'clock. The affairs ran 4 hours with a supper break at midnight. Like the music, supper was always the same, and each community had its own menu. During the interval, many of the men drifted off to the bar for a couple drinks, and a few of the teenagers sneaked to the cars to drink an illicit can of beer or to neck with their dates. Alcohol played a large role, of course. Many of the older bachelors never left the bar to go dancing, but if they did, even when full of whiskey, they observed a certain civility and made an inebriated effort not to call attention to themselves. Actual police presence was unnecessary. A local, temporary deputy, unarmed and without uniform, was enough. It wasn't rare that a couple of the younger bucks who had issues, most often a girl, would go outside to trade punches and insults. They were left to settle the question on their own, but if the fight became disruptive or too violent, the deputy would step in and stop the battle. I don't remember that anyone ever went to jail. On one occasion, two belligerents refused to stay away from each other, and they finally irritated the deputy enough that he handcuffed both of them to the same post on the main street of town. They spent a chilly night in full view of passers-by, but they avoided the complications of arrest. Life was simpler then. We danced in a counterclockwise direction, everyone at the same speed. One old bachelor, now long dead, is still remembered for his square corners. If a pair planned on dancing the next number together, they walked in the same direction as the crowd until the music started again. And when the couple was done dancing, it was customary for the boy or man to walk his partner back to her seat. The first time I saw a younger couple go their separate way while still on the dance floor, I knew our civilization was in decline. Women, married or single, were obligated to dance at least once with almost any man or boy who asked. The first dance was a must, the second was optional, and a third request was taboo unless both parties were single and courtship was in the wind. Personal boundaries were respected. Television and easier travel put an end to the traditional dances. TV allowed the more sedentary to stay at home and still have something to fill the time, and the presence of many non-locals, although always welcome, eliminated the communal, almost familiar atmosphere that was the salient facet of the events. The duck dances, the hay diggers ball, and the elk hunters ball don't happen anymore. They're ancillary to other occasions and aren't special events in themselves. It's a cultural loss, really. The old-style dances promoted a sense of community for children and allowed them to participate in the same leisure activities as their parents and grandparents. That's an anomaly now, almost impossible. Oh, well, there's always Facebook.
You mentioned a couple of times in your essays that television precipitated a homogenous youth culture in the U.S. Do you think it propelled the young people out of the communities and away from the ranches?
Well, it let them know there was an option, yeah, that there was something other than Helmville and haying and stuff. And a friend of mine told me that up in the coast of Alaska there in the native villages that the suicide rate among the youth up there, especially the male youth, is very, very high because they're seeing this outside world and they're stuck on the tundra in the wind. And it's a really a tragedy there. Mm. But the television really accepted more the social life of the small communities, that people could stay home and they weren't dependent on their neighbors for company. They could turn on Ed Sullivan, you know, and do that.
It sounds like it created more isolation in a place that's already isolated.
It did. It did, especially between the neighbors, yeah. The Helmville always had a weekly card party where quite a few of the card players would gather to play pinochle, and that wasted away. And the dances now aren't, aren't really the social occasion that they were. They're not an event in themselves. They're a dance. Television, of course, modified the whole culture, but the country culture, I think we just maybe made us more sedentary or something. I don't know.
Well, going back to your driving with your grandfather, did you ever think about telling your grandfather that taking those trips was an agony for you?
Oh, no. No, you didn't question the man. He was kind, and but he was direct and he was gruff. And cattle is what mattered. There was nothing else had ever been in his life, you know. He was born in Helmville and died there. My office is the room where he died, there at the ranch. My grandfather died in 64 and my grandmother in 86. They had 7 boys, and the last one born, the 8th, was a girl. So the girl was born. Word came to Helmville from Butte that this last child, or the 8th child, was a girl. So my aunt, who's still alive, 94 and healthy, drove over to the ranch to tell my grandfather that he finally had a girl in the family. And they were branding steers. And she went out and she said, Tom, Madge had a baby girl. He never turned his head from his work. He said, good, another cook.
Oh.
So possibly sexist, sure, as you know, that was in the 30s. Surely it's very sexist, but not a contrived sexism. That was the role that women played.
Mm-hmm.
But he was direct that way. Yeah, he was a pretty dynamic man.
Sounds like he was very practical.
Very so, yeah. He was an autocrat, really, you know, the head of a tribe of 7 boys, a fairly good ranch and stuff. But I wasn't afraid of the man, but there just he just did what was expected.
Even if you were in agony?
Oh, yeah. Well, the theme is that the agrarian work ethic, I think, is second to none as per the self-discipline needed to do it. Just as a minor example, we buried my mother in the 80s, and I left the funeral a little early because I had hay to bale. You know, she was already ashes, so, and the hay was getting dry, so I baled the hay. And another time, my uncle collapsed on the kitchen floor. It was during calving. He'd suffered recurrent bleeding ulcers and wouldn't tell anybody till he fell down, and we took him to town. But anyway, one morning, Huey collapsed on the floor and said, Dick, I have to go to the hospital. But we were calving. And I said, okay, as soon as I check the heifers. And he knew his place. He expected nothing else. Now, we're at lunch with the governor or something. You'd grab the phone. You'd say, I'm going to be late. My uncle's bleeding to death on the kitchen floor. But I helped him up, and I drove through the heifers, and everything was all right, so we went to town. Now, if something had been wrong, if I had trouble with a cow, I don't know what I'd done. I think I'd have taken care of the cow. And those are all the people I know in ranches have that same ethic. But now with the internet, of course, and different things, the younger generations, don't see that as quite necessary. And maybe it never was.
What do you want people who live in places like New York City or Cleveland or Chicago to know about what it's like to be a rancher in Montana?
It's not romantic. You just get up in the morning and go to work. And if a ranch has 8 or 10,000 acres, every acre needs something done to it. So you just plod on and try and keep your financial head above water so the next generation up can do the same thing. I doubt if any parents would wish that lifestyle on a kid, because the romance really isn't there. It's, you know, it's not riding the range on a noble horse or anything. Like, to ranchers, a horse is the same thing as a refrigerator or a lawnmower is to something else, is to an urban family. They're treated well and respected, but they're a tool. So there's really no romance in it after a while. And a lot of people are disappointed in that when they come to a ranch and just see the day-to-day monotony and drudgery of working 90 hours a week.
And getting up at 3 a.m. to check the heifers when it's 30 below.
Yeah, that's a given. Because animals don't understand later when they're hungry or anything. So you take care of your animals. You know, it's not an exciting lifestyle. It's just day to day. And there is so much work involved in a ranch. It's like punching a pillow or something. You just do what has to be done and go home when it's dark.
And it never ends.
It never ends. Our ranch is 150 years old, and there are things that my great-grandfather did wrong that we haven't had time to fix yet.
Oh, jeez.
I think the ranchers, you know, Buffalo Commons was a book some years ago, you know, about how the ranching industry, the cow-calf industry, is, you know, destroying the environment. But I think as a lifestyle that depends on taking things from the earth, the cow-calf people do better than anyone in protecting and respecting the earth, simply because we can't afford to move in with equipment and do any more damage. The more you rest it, the better land you have. And so it's not a question of going in and turning it into a model operation. We don't plow. It's too expensive. We just do what has to be done. And the prices on cow-calf operations can't support any large-scale investment to increase the productivity of the ground. So it's a maintenance of subsistence lifestyle, although it's a good one.
Richard Gary lives near Helmville, Montana. You'll find more information about him as well as links to our podcast and Facebook page at mtpr.org/twq. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.